To Mond, McGill, and good morning and welcome to McGill. I would like to take this opportunity to thank you for showing up this relatively cloudy morning to Learning to Teach Day. Before we begin, I'm probably like most of you, I'm shocked to see the saddened news in Paris. For those of you who have family or friends or are here from Paris, our condolences and sympathies. A tragic event. However, I just thought I would start there. We are happy to welcome guests. Not only McGill students are here today, but guests from University of Montreal, INRS, and Concordia. So welcome to the McGill campus for Learning to Teach Day. My name is David Sincox. I'm the Graduate Education Officer. I send you skill sets emails, and which is probably the reason why most of you are here today. This is a great turnout. We have a full day of events, and some of you that I bumped into this morning, you told me you had some challenges picking from the workshops. I'm glad you had that challenge because it means you're thinking about your own teaching, which is why we're here today, to learn about teaching and how people learn. Few housekeeping pieces. 219 is closed. We will be, if you happen to have a session in room 219, please make your way to 232. So there's a room change for you, and there is signage up for you throughout this Leacock area. Food, there's lots of food and beverages, and I can see all of you have like a coffee or tea. That's great. We bring in fresh whole fruit for you. It's that time of year where we have apples and bananas. Please help yourself. There are some pastries for those people, and just so you know, there are vegetarian options and meat options at lunch. If you've made your notice on your application for vegetarian, please take the vegetarian. And those meat carnivores, please stay away from the vegetarian. Anyone here from Mac Campus? Yes, woo, welcome. So welcome to our friends and our colleagues from McDonald Campus. Thank you for coming in from St. Anne this morning. Today, some of you will use clickers, those little electronic devices that helps to do polling. They will not change the channel at home, nor will they open your garage doors, so leave them here at the university after you're done. So we have an opportunity today. Oh, I should make a special note. That woman over there in the corner, her name is Chloe Garcia. She is responsible for this event. She's a graduate student, a PhD in education. Just a warm thank you to Chloe. So, if there are problems, go to her, not to me. To help start the discussion, your opening speaker this morning is characterized above all else by enthusiasm. He joined McGill's Faculty of Management in 2000, and he teaches graduate courses on globalization and leadership. He has taught extensively in executive education and MBA programs around the world at leading universities like Oxford, Cambridge, Cornell, and Duke and McGill. His current research is on postmodern leadership and globalization, and his teaching extends across the undergrad as well to the Hot Cities of the World tour. In 2016, he's taking a group to Chile. I volunteered, and he doesn't have a spot for me, unfortunately. He is an award-winning professor. In 2012, Faculty Award for Excellence in Alumni Activities. 2012 as well, gold medal in the best use of social media. 2012, Canadian Council of Advancement of Education, the CCAE Prix d'Excellence. And in 2002, recognized as McGill's Faculty Distinguished Teaching Award. Among other things, that Professor Carl Moore is. He's also on CJAD 800, so after this lecture, if you really like him, you can go and listen to him there. You can also follow him on the Globe and Mail CEO series, both video and text. I am very honored to introduce to you Professor Carl Moore.
Well, thanks, Dave, and good morning, everyone. It's awfully early on a Saturday morning, and I was here an hour ago because I got my schedule wrong, so I'm really just waking up. So appreciate the coffee, Chloe. That's very helpful. We're actually going to Chile and Colombia both, so it's a lot of fun. So I want to talk a bit about kind of different approaches to teaching. May not be different to you, but it's certainly different to many of our faculty that teach you. And I first started teaching when I was doing my PhD, and I did the first minor in teaching in our PhD program. because even though we're measured almost entirely by research at McGill, what we do is teach a lot. And so I thought it would be only appropriate that if I'm going to have a career that involves research and some teaching, I should learn a bit about how to be a more effective teacher. So I did a minor and created a minor in teaching in my PhD. Started teaching at Oxford, and well, I taught at the U of T in York a bit as well, but while I was doing my PhD. And one of the great traditions in Oxford is one-on-one tutoring with undergraduates, which is incredibly expensive. Only in Oxford and Cambridge still do it. And it's where you sit in your office. Now, at Oxford, if you've ever been there, you have palatial offices. My office at McGill is 1/6 the size of my Oxford office. This still ticks me off. 15 years later, I still haven't come to terms with it. Because back in the day, to be a don, a professor at Oxford or Cambridge, you were a single man who was a minister of the Church of England, and you lived in your office. So my friends had offices with showers and bedrooms and everything else. Fireplaces. I was a newer college, so we didn't have a bedroom, but we had a huge office. So what I would do is get in my office, and there was a little screen with fish outside my office where the fish would leap. You'd hear the sound of a fish landing occasionally. And I would put on Bach. And what the student do, an undergraduate, would start reading their paper. So a couple weeks before I said, we're going to talk about this theory. Can you write a paper on it? And they would start reading. And I put my feet up because I'm from Canada. So I was allowed to. The British took great offense at this. But I crossed my foot. It's my office. And put on my desk. Put on Bach. The sounds of fish leaping outside. You can just picture the scene. And they would start reading. And I would interrupt them in their title. And I would say, I disagree. You should use the word but rather than however. And we'd go through it word for word. And in the first time they do this, so they came from other countries, almost anyone to Oxford was not used to this because they're used to a classroom of 30, 40, 50, 100 people, and it was one-on-one, you with a senior person. You might be smarter, but they're not going to let allow you that was true. And you'd go through, and it was incredibly powerful. So what we're trying to do is think kind of an Oxford tradition of how do you get people to be more engaged, how do you get them to talk more. On our Masters of Practicing Management, our leadership programs, I run with Henry Mintzberg. We have the 50-50 rule, where at most the professors can speak 50% of the time, at most. So again, this goes back to the idea of more focusing on the students. And it fits with a book I'm doing on postmodern management. So the idea of the book in one sentence, there's seats down here if you want to come down, it won't bother me. So come on down and have a seat here, if you're so inclined. I'll pause for a second. So the idea of postmodern management is saying people over 45 with the university degree were taught a modern worldview. People under 35 with the university degree, you guys, have been taught a postmodern worldview, must be led or managed differently. It's the worldview we're teaching younger people like yourselves is quite different than the worldview that I was taught. One of the central points is the decline, if not death, of hierarchy. So when I was a kid, I'd go to a doctor. The doctor was a man back then. He'd have a white coat on, a stethoscope around him as a symbol of authority, and he'd have a desk you could land an aircraft on. And my mom would take me, and he was God, and we were here. Today, when I go to my doctor, it's a woman. Most of our students at McGill of Medicine are women. And we sit chairs beside each other. She doesn't have any uniform on, no signs of authority. And I sit beside her and go, Doc, I Googled what's wrong with me on the way here, and I have three theories. What do you think? Do you guys do that with your physicians? So again, I've taught this. I did grand rounds in Saudi Arabia and Burma, and they both agreed in those countries it was just like that back home. So I figure if it's like that in Saudi Arabia and Burma, it's probably like that here in Montreal. So authority is much less. So when you look at learning, the students call me Carl because I ask them to, and they have no problem with that. Now, our MBA in Tokyo, the Japanese still wrestle with that. Now, I'm old enough that I'm in charge, you're not, there's not going to be an uprising. Is that a fair statement? There's no question at my age I have authority, and we're not contesting that. Now, if I was 27, 28, I might wear a tie as a man and a suit just to have a bit of authority as a younger man. But I'm not worried about that. But that also affects, the students are going, my story is almost as good as your story, in spite of your 27 referee journal articles and 10 books. My story is almost as good as your story. So I think we got to change how we teach. See, I'm allowed to say, as someone who speaks English, well, gotta. because it's poor English, but I speak so well, I'm allowed to do that. If you're Francophone, you can't do it. Okay, so sorry about that. So it's something where it ain't it true, though. So again, poor English, but I'm allowed to because I speak well normally. So I want to talk about, give you an example of how I'm doing this. So I'm doing some research on introverts in the executive suite. So I presented this at a couple different locations in the last month, and I'm just going to show you an example of what I mean by this. Okay? So I'll show you by... So one of the things I start off with is I interviewed for the Globe and Mail General Martin Dempsey, who's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, until about a month ago in the U.S., a four-star general, the most senior general in the world. He sits behind Obama when they talk about war. Okay? So he said something very interesting, that generals fight the battles of their youth. What he means by that is that he was out of West Point, had a tank in the Cold War as a lieutenant, and he learned a lot about leadership and strategy from men and women that had been soldiers, young people in Vietnam. He became a general in Desert Storm. The point is, the strategies of leadership and of war were very different between Vietnam, the Cold War, and Desert Storm. Is that a fair statement? What he's saying is that you learn penetrating lessons about leadership and about teaching in your 20s, early 30s, but you become a general in your 50s. He says what you got to do is throw a lot of your learnings over the side of the boat. Does that make sense to you? Okay. So I will talk to, and this, I say this to executives who are older and hearing is going, that, and they agree. And then what I say to them at this point, in groups of three, discuss a lesson you've had to throw over the side of the boat from your 20s. So if you guys were not, if you guys were older, there's a bit of gray here, I would ask you in groups of three to discuss that idea. What I've done is present an idea in 2 minutes. Now I'm going to have 2 or 3 minutes of you discussing that idea. And I do it in groups of three because like when we teach our IMPM, IMHO and so on, we have round tables, so there is no front of the classroom. Here there's clearly a front where I'm the authority, I'm in charge, you're not, and the room reinforces that thought, where it slants down to me as the font of all knowledge and truth, right? Which is silly, but that's the way it is. Round floors, not round floor, flat floors, round tables, got to get that right, there is no front of the classroom. Sir Henry Mintzberg, who's our most famous professor probably at McGill, one of the great gurus in the world of management, he gets up at the front of programs and says, Carl and I have PhDs, we've written books, and that's good, but your knowledge is as valuable or more valuable than our knowledge. And when Mintzberg says that, everybody goes, wow, that's incredible. So if he says it means that I've got to mean it even more. So in our classroom, we have that setup which says there is no front, there is no one place of knowledge. This classroom is contrary. So to break that down a little bit, I have in groups of three, and why I choose three is because you can hear each other, and two may be too much pressure on one person to perform, where five or six, someone's going to get lost in the shuffle. So that's why I use three, because you can hear each other, and it allows the introverts an out. A time to think a little bit. Will someone else, the extrovert, jump right in? So what I would normally do is have you discuss this, and I'll have you do a discussion in a minute, and then what I do is I then share a couple lessons I've had to throw away. One is, when I worked for IBM, information is power that I would hold close to my chest, because then I can manipulate you as a manager. But what I say in today, in the world of Google, I can't do that anymore. In fact, what we're doing in big companies is sharing information. I interviewed the CEO of Uber last night for my radio show. And Uber is fascinating because one of my other students came to class, works at Uber, brought a guy whose first day at Uber was that day. His second hour was in my classroom. That guy could see any information the GM of Quebec could see. And in fact, I think pretty much any information that the CEO could see other than salaries. Incredible amount of knowledge that we share now, and as a manager, as a leader, I no longer have that power over you. I don't know if that makes sense to you in terms of your age, but a dramatic shift in the world. So what I go through and share some of my own experiences about credentials, about hierarchy, and just say, but what it is, I'd have you in groups of three discuss, and then I would do, and I would go around listening to people's ideas. So I would listen in, and when I listen in, I get down because I'm tall, like this. So I'm not towering over you. I'm at your own level. And I don't look you in the eye, because I don't want to stop the conversation. So if you're talking, and you look at me and expect me, I'll say, keep talking, and I'll look away, because I don't want to be part of that. I don't want to dominate the conversation. So again, some of you are not as tall, you don't have to worry about this, but again, I often sit on the edge of the desk rather than standing or get down because I want to reduce that hierarchy. And I want their conversation to be, but I'll listen and say, that was real interesting. And I'll say, do you mind if I call on you? And most people say, sure. Because I'm saying as the authority, I think it's a good idea, I'd like to hear from you. And what's your name?
Edward.
So then I would say, you know, I get here and say, I just overheard Edward, I think, said something interesting. Edward, would you mind sharing? So right away, when we talk about the ideas that we've thrown over the side of the boat, Edward's talking. And then I'll go up and choose other people where I present an idea for a minute or two, as you saw. We have conversation for 3 minutes among yourselves. And then we have 3 or 4 minutes where you guys share your learnings. Why? Because then you own the idea better. You it's not only intellectually you got it, but you've applied it, and now you own it. And you can apply that and talk to other people about that. And you might go home and talk to someone about these ideas. So I've been doing I give a speech where I talk about where I've learned the most about leadership in the last 10 years is from three groups: millennials, introverts, and women. And clearly I'm not two of those. And I think you sussed out I'm probably not an introvert either. But that might take a little bit more. Because actually, introverts can be great professors, great teachers, if they know what they're talking about. And you give them time to think about it. Absolutely tremendous presenters. Extroverts can talk about anything, and sometimes they're entirely making it up, is the danger. Okay? But introverts, so one of the things I talk about with millennials, and I talk to older people, is that when I was young, mentoring is one way, 99% down. I mentor today, and I have 5 undergraduates working for me, where 75% of the time I'm mentoring them, 25% of the time they're mentoring me, what we call reverse mentoring. I'm learning from them at 20 years old. And it's because the world is so different. Social media, for example. They get social media. They understand it in a way I don't. I do a lot of social media, but they just get it because it's the world they live in. And I have teenagers, so it's just unbelievable amount of time they spend on their screens. Unbelievable. So when I talk about introverts, I'll discuss, you know, I'm doing some work with Susan Cain, who wrote a book called Quiet. I don't know if you've seen it. It's sold about 3 million copies. It's in 40 languages. An incredible seller. And Susan is probably the most famous introvert in the world, though Obama's an introvert and he's better known. But as an introvert, that's what she's known for. And very interesting person. And talking about introverts, just talk about my research base, for a moment talk about what is introversion. And the central idea of introversion versus extroversion is amount of stimulation someone can take before they need to stop and reflect and think. Now, your mom probably told you to think before you speak. Does this ring a bell? Certainly, they taught you that in kindergarten. So extroverts did not learn that well, okay? Introverts did. And so when we look at it, it's really about how much stimulation. Introverts love people. They're great communicators. They're great leaders. But after a certain amount of stimulation, they need to take a break and reflect. Extroverts can take more stimulation before they need to reflect. That's a central construct behind the idea that we look at introverts and extroverts. So you guys happy with that? So it's different than shyness. Shyness is about social judgment, so a different construct. Extroverts like me love large amount of stimulation. When I go to a bar, my wife and kids aren't with me, I take my iPad to read, but I go to a bar to eat and I talk to the people beside me. When I get on the plane, I always talk to the people beside me if they speak English or French. If they speak Russian, I'm lost. Okay? But it's something where, do you do that? Do you go to the bar and talk to total strangers? Do you? It's sad, but you do. I'm there with you. On planes. So something where it's the nature of extrovert that we love that stimulation. It helps to be older and Canadian, because when people find out Canadian, they talk more slowly, but I'm harmless. Okay? So it's a very helpful thing. So introverts love quieter. So talking to Paul Desmarais, who runs the Power Corp, very famous, he and his wife go to parties, very well-known couple, Ellen goes from table to table talking to everyone. They love her. She's very popular. She says nothing of substance. Paul talks to three people for a half hour each. At the end of it, they go, a billionaire spent a half hour listening to me. I love the man. Paul says, Ellen says, Paul, you should be like me. I disagree. Both are real strengths. Both are valuable. But it's the nature of the person. Though you have to learn and lean in a little bit to be like the other. Now, so at this point, I'll have you do a very short test. So read that from 1 to 5, whether 5 being very much, 1 not at all like, and come up with a number from 5 to 25. You have 10 seconds starting now. So we have a number? Okay. So who's between 20 and 25? Just put your hand up. Okay. Who's between 15 and 20? Who's below 15? Now, it's interesting because that's not quite a normal distribution. In a most groups, I did this at Memorial University in Newfoundland last week, for executives and undergrads, you'd have more extroverts, which is intriguing, but you're graduate students, right? Many professors, probably the majority, are introverts, and they love doing research with numbers and stats, and they teach well, they go back to the office, close the door. Many of my colleagues, we never see them in their non-teaching semester. They come back tanned, but they come back having been somewhere where they enjoy for days being by themselves and thinking profound thoughts, which they do. I can't work at home. My kids, when we moved here, were 2 and 4, so they would bug me. And, you know, I'd say, go away, I'm supporting you, which is a concept they didn't get. So I would go to work because they would bug me, but I go to work now that they're teenagers, they're not at home, because I need human interaction. I write for an hour and a half. At that point, I must go down and talk to human beings. The advantage of a university is I have an endless supply of 20-year-olds that are happy to talk to me because I've been giving them grades. So it's something where they're going to, you know, they come down, they smile, and they talk with me because it knows it's just good for them. It's wise. So I need 15 minutes of human contact, then I go back and write for an hour and a half. My introverted colleagues don't need that. We look at each other, and we don't quite understand each other, okay? So when you look at it, what I would normally, well, in fact, we're going to do this now. Groups of three, discuss which you are of introvert, ambivert, or extrovert. Ambivert's kind of in the middle. And why do you say that? Give a brief bit of evidence, starting now, in groups of three. Sort it out. Everybody look to their right. Everybody look, oh, that won't work, will it? So anyway, in groups of three. That's fine, I'll be done by then.
So 10:30 is when
okay. Sorry to interrupt a good conversation, but what I wanted to show you is what's the energy in the room 5 seconds ago? It was high, so as soon as I stop talking and you start talking, every person is engaged. Every person's energy level shoots up because you're talking, either you're saying something or you're listening to the two people beside you and you're going to have something to say. So again, it's something you can do it in any classroom because three people, you could hear each other. It was a bit noisy, the group behind you was pretty noisy, I felt. But, you know, something where you're engaging in it. And what you're doing is applying the idea. You're applying the idea so you have greater ownership of the idea through the pure application of it. Does that make sense? So when you think about it, a couple quick takeaways, because a lot of you are probably introverts because of the nature of your studying, is that introverts are great people that are excellent leaders. In fact, I'm doing research where I'm interviewing CEOs of companies over 5,000, so big companies, and about 25% of CEOs are introverts. About 30% of C-suite executives are introverts. And it's a Darwinian struggle to get to the top. It shows the incredible value introverts have. Now, if you're a CEO, and again, this is true of a professor that many of you will be someday, is that Claude Mongeau runs CN, 25, 24,000 people, big train company here in Montreal. Claude is a McGill MBA, an introvert. When he leaves his floor in the négociateur, he puts on his game face and acts like an extrovert. Why is that, do you think? Why does he have to act like an extrovert? What's that? Well, he's CEO. So, in fact, he had a training where he had a coach that taught him the five-click method of becoming more extroverted. So he gave him a clicker like a someone has in a bar, like a, what do they call it, a bouncer, okay? So the bouncer has a thing, clicks how many people come in or at a football game, things like that. And so he said, Claude, five times a day, you've got to act like an extrovert. So at the end of the day, you look at the clicker and say, did I make it or not? So when he gets in the elevator, so an introvert might get in an elevator and just look at your feet. You don't say hi to anyone, which is all right if you're a starting person, but if you're the CEO and, what's your name?
Julius.
So if I get in and I'm the CEO and Julius is there, is someone a couple levels down, I ignore him. What is Julius saying to himself? You're not worth, gee. So I mean, I'll give you a hug afterwards. So that. No, what you're saying is that, yeah, no, in a certain degree, you know, I'm not worthy, he hates me, I'm going to get my resume and send it to CP, our competitor in Calgary. So you overreact. So what you should do as CEO, I get in the morning, I go, morning, Julius. And I look in the face, use your name, and I smile, and I say something like, boy, that's cold out there, which is hard to argue with. It's something where I'm not going, I'm not trying to stir up controversy and say, hey, the Leafs are terrible. Well, Montreal, you could say that. And they are terrible, so it's a statement of actual empirical fact. But it's something where you're just connecting with him as a human being, and you're there, and Julius feels better. Because the great one recognized me, he knows my name, I feel better, I'm going to keep working here, I feel more motivated. That's somewhat, but not entirely overstating it, isn't it? That's the nature of it. So the principal, McGill, schmoozes me when she sees me. But Heather Monroe Bloom, the old principal, I saw her. She hasn't been principal about 2 years. I saw her walking down Green Avenue the other day. So we stopped and chatted about my trip to Colombia and Chile. We're done. She walks away about 20 feet, stops, and turns back and says, Carl, you do a great job with students. She's stroking me 2 years after she's no longer my leader. She still strokes me because she's an excellent leader. What's she doing is, and I go away going, I do useful things. Because someone three or four levels up says I do useful things. Now, I should hopefully be old enough to not worry about what other people think and so on, but it's still nice if someone like that is recognizing you. Does that make sense? So it's saying as an introvert, he's got to act like an extrovert on occasion to be a more effective leader. Now, if you don't want to be a leader, that's fine. Don't act like that. Now, what I've argued that as an extrovert, when I leave my office, I don't have a floor, I have to put on my game face and act like an introvert to be a better leader. So how do you think I should act like an introvert to be a better leader? What do you think? What's that? Better listener? Anything else comes to mind? Oh, you're being mutually supportive, so that's good. So you didn't add a lot of detail, but it's, you know, it reinforced it. So thinking, yeah. So the idea is that introverts are better at listening. They tend to think before they speak, and so that's very helpful as well. It's also that I don't need to be the center of attention. So in fact, as an older person, I should put the focus on younger people that work with me because it's the right thing to do as you get more senior. So it's something where, you know, it's when you have children, at about age 10, you no longer have a name as a parent. You become the father or mother of Eric, my son. So you go to school and you don't have a name, you're Eric's father. And you go, wait a minute, I'm more important than a 10-year-old. I have more education, I make a lot more money, I'm more recognized. Like, you know, and you go, I'm more important. But you go, and if you play sport with a small child, you should let them win. The fact is that as a grown man or woman, you can beat a 12-year-old. We're not impressed. The fact is that you have to beat her shows you're sad. So part of an extrovert wants to be the center of attention. So maturity is, as a leader, you focus attention elsewhere. So as an extrovert, I need to act like an introvert to be a more effective leader. So both sides have got to reflect on the other. Okay, so we talk about this. And then what I get to, so what I go through and talk a little bit about the strengths and weaknesses of extroverts and introverts. So after about 3 minutes of talking, I get on to another interactive workshop where I say, in your groups of three, discuss what are the leadership strengths of an introvert. You discuss that for 3-4 minutes, and then I'd have a flip chart or a blackboard, and I'd get you to shout out what they are, and then I might add one or two along there. But what I'm doing is, so again, it's about 50, probably 60-40, where 40% of the time I'm talking, 60% of the time you're talking to each other. It's peer learning. And it's something where the great thing is you're more apt to remember it afterwards. Absolutely. Okay? So what we do is go through strengths of introverts, strengths of extroverts. And then what I do is end up some material on, just looking for my glasses here, material on what are some of the... Did you take my glasses? I can't believe you did that. Okay. No, thanks very much. So we're looking at some advice on how extroverts can work more effectively with introverts, okay? So then I would go through some stuff that I've had a chance to think about and summarize. And the great thing is, I would say, hey, just like you said, great point, and you reflect on it. So it's something where a lot of these would come from the audience themselves. There's greater sense of ownership of the ideas, okay? So you probably read through that, so introverts as well. And then what I give them is some stuff, literature. Now, for managers, I wouldn't give them journals because they don't understand them, because they're written for people with PhDs in the same subject. So if I take one of your literature, I probably can't understand it either because I don't have a PhD in your topic. I have a PhD but in the wrong topic for your literature. So it's something where it's not because we're not smart or well-educated, just it's a different domain. So I give them stuff which I've written. This is some stuff I've written for my Forbes blog and for the Globe and Mail, things that are accessible and they can learn from. So what this is they can follow up later on and reflect on it. And I'll send them an email. So I do some teaching at Aldo, the big shoe company. And what I do is give them ideas, but then I'll send them an email every month or two just saying, here's something that I wrote or someone else wrote. I thought you'd enjoy it. So it's a 3-minute video. It's a 800-word blog post. It's something that you can do in 5 minutes. Well, okay, it's 6 minutes if it's a 6-minute video, but you know what I mean. So it's something where it's not going to be a journal where you can't understand it and it's going to take you hours to sort your way through. It's something which is digestible but renews the idea and brings it back to mind. So it's reinforcing those ideas so there's, again, greater ownership and change in it. Okay, so let me just do one other thing here. So... So one other idea I want to show, and this is just show you an idea which I teach at Aldo and Air Canada. Where's view? So this is an idea which comes from family therapy, and it's called the 5 Languages of Appreciation for Management. It originally started with families, and saying there's 5 ways to show appreciation to the people that work for you. So then the managerial context, it's about people that work for you, and how do you say thank you to them, okay? So it started in family saying, as a parent, a husband, a wife, how do you show appreciation to your spouse and your children? So that's where it came from, but we've applied it. It's been applied to management. So I'll just go through the 5 ways very briefly. So the first is words of appreciation. So you say, what a star. Really appreciate your comments in class. That was very helpful. So I'm showing appreciation by using words to say, you've done well. Okay? So that's one. You tend to have one you prefer. I'll ask you about that in a minute, okay? So just plant that thought in your mind. Another one is quality time. Talk is cheap. What I want is quality time with you. I want to have a coffee and 20 minutes where you listen to me. Where it's not about words, me saying words, it's about me listening to you, okay? Now, I don't know if any of you are married, but it is often typical that what I've learned over many years of marriage is that my wife wants to share her feelings. She doesn't want my advice. Now, I'm a man, I'm an MBA, I'm a manager, so generally it's problem, solution, problem, solution, problem, solution. So if someone comes with a problem, I would give them a solution or lead them to a solution. She doesn't want this. So in fact, my wife, when she wants my advice, will say to me, what do you think I should do? It's very specifically, clearly asking for advice. Otherwise, does that make sense? Any of you married probably understand that this is often dynamic where you really just want to share, you don't want any advice. What I want in quality time is for you to listen to me. Now sometimes I will listen to my wife and she'll say, you're not listening. I will repeat word for word the last three paragraphs what she said, showing with utter total truth that I was listening. This does not appear to be satisfying. And does this resonate with any of you? So I've learned to learn better, like an introvert, and listen better. So people like quality time, these people. So if you want to thank me and show your appreciation, listen to me and give me quality time one-on-one. Another one, other people like acts of service. So with my secretary, when she's really busy, I'll say to her, boy, you've been working hard. I'll do this myself. So it's something that I have every right to ask her to do, but I'll say, I'll do it myself. So it's an act of service, taking away from her that burden. Okay? So that's an example of acts of service. Two more. One is gifts. So some people like small gifts. Now, it's not about the size of the gift. It's about the thought you were thinking about me while you're traveling. So I took a group of students to South Africa. We're on safari. So, you know, a great experience. And I bought a postcard sent to my mother. I got to see my mother months before the postcard actually showed up. But why she appreciated it? Because you were thinking about me when you're having a great time, you thought of your mother. Or, you know, you get a little gift and you take it back to your family. So my kids like T-shirts, so I buy them T-shirts from around the world, often at the airport, because that's where they have them. It's also I may have forgotten to do this, okay? And I've occasionally bought something in the Toronto airport flying from Europe, and then my wife goes, oh, these are Canadian. And it's hard to explain your way out of that, but, you know, at least, hey, at least I bought something. But the idea of a gift is saying, I appreciate you, what you're doing, and I bought you a small gift to show you I care. The final one, which comes from family theory, is touch. Now, obviously, in the work context, you've got to be more careful. Women can do this much more easily, and that's fine, and we understand the reasons why. But what it is that even as a man, though, I can do things with other men. For example, how's your shoulder? So what I'll do is I'll punch a man, particularly young men, in the shoulder as a way of saying, hey, good job. He's never going to sit in the aisle ever again. It's funny, one of the guys lives across the street, young man, I taught him a couple times. He's like 24, plays hockey, giant. So I'm at an occasion with him, and I go up and I punch him in his shoulder, and he goes, ow! He had hurt his shoulder, and then like 10 seconds later, his dad, who's my age, came up and punched him in the same shoulder. He goes, what's wrong with you old guys? So, but it's something where you can punch someone, or you can go like that, or you can high-five with a woman. Like, that's fine, that's not sexual, not even a microaggression. Okay, so something where women have greater latitude, particularly other women. Though it's funny, because in Montreal, I kiss women I know on both cheeks. Okay, so this is normal behavior, not of undergraduate students, but women I know. The only time I would kiss an undergraduate student at graduation with her parents there, because now she's no longer a student, she's now an alumnus. And so alumni that I know, as women, I kiss on both cheeks, and they feel it's treating her like a peer. Now it's funny because Montreal, I can do that. When I go to Toronto, occasionally there's women I know I've known for a while, and I'll kiss them, and you can feel them stiffening up and thinking, lawsuit. In Ottawa, you just never know, because it's French and English, it's utterly confusing. Ottawa is confusing, I think we can agree on that. But in Montreal, it's fine to kiss women both cheeks. And so that touch is more of a Quebec thing in a way, and we hug more. If you're Italian, you tend to hug more, I think, most Italians. I notice among Arab men that they like to get too close to me when they're talking. And so I've seen this where I've danced around rooms with Arab men very slowly. They get too close, and at a reptilian level, I go, he's too close. So I'll move back, but I don't, I'll just move back a little bit, and he goes, he's too far, and he'll move closer. And we're just kind of, you know, slowly moving around the room. Does this make sense? So something where it's a cultural thing to some degree. Okay, so touch is all right, but with some context. So the question I'd like to ask you is, in groups of three, which of the five do you prefer? Discuss that for 1 minute starting now. Which of the five do you tend to prefer? Okay, so so at the back there, what's your name? I'm sorry? Marisol. You must be from Mexico, I bet. Okay, well, she already told me that, but so which do you prefer? And okay, and touch, okay. And you? Okay, and?
Quality time.
Okay, so how many people, who likes mostly, the most, words of appreciation? Okay, who likes, what's this next one is, quality time? Now, are you guys double dipping here? So I thought, well, okay, that's fine, but who likes acts of service? Not as many, but still quite a few people. Who likes, what am I missing here? Gifts. Who like gifts? Okay, a few of you? Okay, we'll make a note of that. How about touch? Who likes touch? Okay. A little bit too enthusiastic, but... are you Canadians, or... Yeah, I mean, did you grow up somewhere else? Where'd you grow up?
Barcelona.
Okay. There's some cultural overlay. When you look at introverts, China... From what Chinese students tell me, and I've been there, I teach a Chinese program with Renmin University in English, that China, young people are taught to be more introverted in their behavior at school. Okay? So there's somewhat of a cultural overlay. I think in Quebec here, there's more touching, seems to be, I think Spain as well, Italy, more the Mediterranean cultures are more touching, where my mother's Finnish, and in Finland, we don't touch as much. Just a little bit different culture. But again, there's wide variety within the culture of what you have there. So Finns are famous as being very introverted. So I know one introvert joke, which I will share with you. So how do you tell a Finnish introvert from a Finnish extrovert? A Finnish introvert looks at his shoes when he's talking to you. A Finnish extrovert looks at your shoes. So something where there's some truth to that. And when I teach in Finland, you ask for questions, there's utter silence for 1 minute. Which in North America, assume that there's no questions. They're actually thinking about what you said, and it's hard to be against that. That's hard to say, guys, wish you wouldn't think. Because it's just silly, isn't it? So there is some cultural overlay there. So when you look at it, there's a range of what people like here. Now, I want to give you two thoughts. One is, you tend to give the one you like. Does that make sense? So if you like words of appreciation, you give that. Now, as a manager, stop doing that. Why do I say that? Anyone guess why? I'm saying if you're a manager, stop giving the one you like. Why do I say that? Yeah. Say what it's saying, if I'm trying to express appreciation, what's your name?
September.
Yeah, no, I get that. Yeah, no, I've heard it. Is that septembre in French? See, I'm just showing off. But so I've got to speak French in public. That was it. I hope you enjoyed it. It's over. So if I want to show appreciation to September, it's not about what I like to give. It's what she likes to receive. What do you like to receive?
Words of appreciation.
Well, that was not helpful. But let's assume that it was quality time. Do you like quality? Does anyone? No. Oh, very good. Okay, sorry about that, September. So, what's your name?
Reza.
Which is October in... Anyway, so Reza. So when you look at it, the quality time is something that I like words of appreciation. I'm good at giving them, but that's not what he wants. And I'm trying to show appreciation to him. I give him what he wants. This is not blindingly obvious when you think about it. You go, yeah. It makes sense, doesn't it? But it's an insight. A lot of people go, that's actually a good point. I just keep giving what I like to get, but it's not about me. It's about them and doing on to them as they'd like to be done to. As to your point, that's exactly right. So what you need to do as a manager is be able to fluently speak all five. Now, touch, you've got to use some care with, but the other ones, you've got to be able to speak all five. And in fact, if someone likes touch, if it's another man, that's fine. I can put my arm around them and that sort of thing. But I've got to be more careful as a senior man, particularly university. And that's entirely appropriate and right. But it's something where I can high-five people, I can, you know, put my arm around young men and so on, where that's perfectly acceptable. But the other four, no problem at all. And so, but I still write handwritten notes to the, I have CEOs come to class, so I write them a handwritten note and send it to them because you never get handwritten notes. Well, you rarely do anyway. And when you do, you go, whoa, I'm impressed that someone took the care out. So that's a simple point. Now, how do you figure out what a person likes? So I have someone coming to work for me. How do I know which of the five they like? There's three things that come to mind. How would I know? Sounds like a song. How do I know? Who sings that? Houston. Yeah. Whitney Houston.
Yeah.
I guess so. Okay, so how will I know what someone likes? What advice would you have?
Ask them.
So it's brutal, but just ask them. So I wrote a Forbes blog, and I give it to my students who work for me and say, which do you like? Come and tell me. And they're smart, and they just tell me. And then I try to remember that. What's another way? You could watch. So good empirical data, but it might take a little while, but it's a good way to watch them and try all five. Another one is ask their old manager or someone to work with them and say, what is he like? What is she like? And then just give it to them. So again, you get this idea. So what we've learned now in the last 12 minutes or so is there's five languages, five ways to say thank you. That we tend to like one. We give that. Don't do that. Give what they need. Do you get that idea? Now, I run into you a month from now, you'd remember that. You would struggle to remember the five, perhaps, but you could Google it easy enough, and I suspect that you may apply this tonight to your roommate. Because you want to say, you know what, the roommate washed my clothes or something. Has that ever happened? Well, it happened my freshman year, and a guy, Guy Rocky, he's a senior executive at Walmart in Arkansas, and he shrunk all my shirts. So this is not a good thing to do, but you know, it's something where you want to see that appreciation and you want to express it. This is an idea you can apply tonight. When you think about introverts and extroverts, you know what you are, but the idea you could apply this thinking in a classroom fairly quickly and go, you know what? Introverts have got to think before they speak, and this is good. One, it's wise, but two, it's the nature of the person. Therefore, in the classroom context, I don't call on someone who's an introvert right away because they're not prepared. The good news is when they are prepared, they have better ideas when they've thought it through, and often better than the extrovert. So when I want to think about ideas, I'll go down and see a colleague, and I'll go down to their office and talk for 15 minutes, and then I'll say, thanks very much. And they'll go, for what? I didn't say a word. But I need someone to bounce ideas off. I get ideas with other people, not with myself in a room. So knowing the nature of that, I accept it, but I have dumb ideas and a few good ones. The dumb ones simply don't matter. I'm not embarrassed at all. I'm not embarrassed. Because what matters is the good idea, not the 10 dumb ones. Does that make sense? Introverts don't see it quite that way. So if I have introverts working for me in a meeting, what I'll do is that I won't call them right away. I'll wait for a while, then I'll look at them, and I'll just nod slightly and see what they say. If they're ready, they'll nod at me. Next one will go, yeah. But an introvert will just nod, yes or no. And then I'll say, hey, John, what do you think? John will then come with beautifully, fully formed ideas that are great and superior to mine to some degree. So I've learned to lean in to what an introvert wants. So what I've talked about is two ideas and presented two ideas, but more fundamentally I'm talking about how do you teach. We're less hierarchical in the past because your story is as good as mine. It's called The Death of Meta-Narratives, The Rise of Micro-Narratives from English literature. So that I have less authority than I did in the past. What we're doing in teaching is the power of ideas. And what you want to do is have a lot of time when the students are talking to each other, discussing. You want them to share those ideas much more than you lecturing. So I've lectured a bit this morning, but probably half the time or a good part of the time you were talking, whether in your small group or you were talking from the audience. What I would suggest that fits with the millennials and the Generation Z that are coming along, and it's the way that's even more effective than in the past. So thanks for your time this morning. Hope the day goes well.
If anybody has a question or two, we can take a few before going for break. Anybody have anything they would like to ask or add? Is that a question or a scratch? No? Yes? Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Could you please give tips on in making sure that the introverts are engaged in class during a discussion? So in the case when the teacher asks a discussion question and invites the class to raise their hands and then the introverts never raise theirs, so what do you do?
Well, it's something where we do a lot of case studies in the business school. One is they get to read the case, so that's helpful because they've actually had a chance to reflect on it. But what I do is that if someone struggles with that, I'll go up to them and say, you're not commenting a lot. Is it just hard to do at times? And say, look, I'm going to call on you, but I'm not going to call on you right away. I'll call on you 5 or 6, 7, other 8 people in, just to let you know. And here's the topic so you can prepare your thinking. So I try to take a context where they have time to think because that's what they require. So I give them that time to think and call them later in the process and give them warning. And I try to give this to the whole class. We're going to be discussing this on Monday. So I might send an email on Saturday morning saying, here's a couple things to read. So that they're prepared and they have a chance to think. So as an introvert, it fits with their learning and their communication style. So that's what I try to do in terms of encouraging introverts. In this case, I talk about introverts so that people are aware that I'm thinking about it. Letting them groups of three discuss empowers them in the sense they've had a time to discuss. They've got feedback from their colleagues saying that was good. They might hear it from me. So when I call on them, they're more relaxed because they've thought about it. And other people have said it's a good idea, so that they're reinforced that, in fact, it is a good idea. So that's just giving that time makes a big difference, I think.
Do we have time for one other question over here?
I was wondering if you could maybe comment fast on this question of authority again. So I think I understood what you meant with that hierarchies is not as important anymore, but I'm more from a background in science, and I wanted to know if you could comment on the authority of facts. So at some point, what is the point of discussing in a group if the group doesn't really know what is being talked about? At some point, someone has to lecture something.
No, like what I talk about today, introvert and extroverts, everybody knows it or can lean into that. The five languages, like it's something where there's not a privileged knowledge very much. Okay? So I agree, but postmodern thought suggests that emotions are as important as facts. And that's not entirely true, but that's what young people are taught. So that my feelings, my emotions are something that must be listened to. So when you look at managing them, you've got to listen to them. If you don't, you're a jerk. So unless it's truly an emergency, like we saw in Paris last night, where the president's got to get up and say something, and Trudeau's got to say something, and Obama's got to say something, and that's it. Unless that, 99% of the time, thankfully, we're not an emergency, I've got to listen to young people and privilege their knowledge and all. But simply, they believe emotions are as important. But I agree that in some cases, someone actually knows what they're talking about. Like if I have knee surgery, I want someone. Have you ever had surgery where they put you out and you start at 100 and count down? What you don't want to hear at 98 is, oh, this is my first one. It's something that would wake you up. You go, no, it's not. I'm getting up. I'm getting out here. Like, and we know there's the first one, but it's a very senior doctor guiding the young doctor. But we don't want to hear about it because it just would scare us silly. So it's something where I think there is a certain amount in science of truth and knowledge with a capital T at times. Though we recognize that what I was taught in science, we've overthrown, and now we make fun of, and we mock. Your professors mock what I was taught. But the professors who taught me were utterly convinced. So we have a little bit more humility than we used to have, because we know the field will advance and go on to newer understanding and time. But there's some truth, knee surgery, there's some truth about my knee. Now, there'll be hopefully in 20 years when my knees need it, there'll be better surgery. And there's a certain amount of truth, I agree, in science, where you can't just have a conversation about opinions. And what we talked about today, I think you can. Not that you're experts, but I think it's something everybody could engage with without feeling that it was totally making it up. But you have a fair point. But I think partly the truth is there's less truth than there used to be. But I agree in science there is truth. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to our morning plenary, and thank you to Professor Moore. We will be having a 15-minute break. Your session starts at 10:45. In the meantime, go get some coffee, cookies, fruits, and see you soon.